This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's John Doe Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see johncast.net.
Hi, we have three questions today. So we're going to start with Mick Carling, that's saying, my son Ben suddenly came out with, Dad, is it never a true full moon because the sun will have to be directly behind you and then the moon will be in shadow? Thinking about it, I cannot follow his logic. Is it true?
Yes, it's true. It's what we call a lunar eclipse, and there's one happening next month. Most people are familiar with the fact that solar eclipses happen when the moon comes in front of the sun, as seen from the Earth. But the Earth can also come in front of the sun, as seen from the moon. Now, this doesn't happen every month, because the moon's orbit is tilted slightly, by about 5 degrees, to the Earth's orbit around the sun. But every now and again they can come into alignment, and the moon passes through the Earth's shadow. Now, if you're in Europe and have clear skies in the evening of Thursday, the 25th of April, have a look out to the east. The moon will rise at sunset, just before 9 p.m. British Summer Time. It'll be maximum eclipse at that time, and will look like it's had a big chunk taken out of it where the Earth's shadow lies. And over the next couple of hours, the moon will slowly pass out of the Earth's shadow and regain its normal full brightness. If you're living in the UK and want to see a total lunar eclipse, where the entire moon disappears behind the Earth's shadow, you're going to have to wait until the early morning of the 28th of September 2015. Lunar eclipses can be quite spectacular, and can sometimes even turn the moon blood red. But that depends on exactly how the light from the sun is refracted through the Earth's atmosphere. But I don't want to wait that long, so I'm going to hope for clear skies on April the 25th.
Pretty good. The next question is from Henry Marston, and he's asking, as the International Space Station interacts with the thin atmosphere where it orbits, it slows down and loses altitude. Every so often, rocket's power has to be used to rise it to a higher orbit. On the other hand, the moon is moving away at its orbit's orbital energy is used to rise tides on Earth. Why does the moon move outwards, but artificial satellites move inward?
Well, Henry's actually answered his own question there. The ISS is dragged into the atmosphere, whereas the moon moves outwards because it's using up its orbital energy raising tides on Earth. These are two fundamentally different processes, and they operate at different altitudes to different bodies. But let's look at this a little closer. Let's take atmospheric drag, for example. The further away from Earth you go, the thinner the atmosphere gets, the less drag you experience. If you can get high enough, the atmosphere peters out and you have no drag. You can go into orbit forever. The ISS and other low-orbit satellites are positioned just inside the point at which atmospheric drag becomes important. Now, that's a trade-off between the expense needed to launch things to higher orbits and the time that they can survive in lower orbits without being dragged into the atmosphere. But if you go a little higher than low Earth orbit, atmospheric drag stops becoming important. Now, once you can ignore atmospheric drag, things become a lot simpler. Whether something moves inwards or outwards is controlled by the tides. Then it all depends on whether the orbiting satellite is going around faster or slower than the Earth spins. If a satellite is in a low orbit, orbiting faster than the Earth spins, then the bulge caused by the tide it exerts on the Earth will tend to drag the satellite back and it will lose energy and spiral in. However, if a satellite is in a high orbit, like the Moon, which orbits slower than the Earth spins, then the tidal bulge will rotate ahead of the satellite and will be pulled forwards, giving it energy and making it spiral away from the Earth. Of course, this also depends on the mass of the satellite, because that controls the size of the tidal bulge it creates. The effect on tiny man-made satellites is negligible. It would take more than the lifetime of the universe for them to spiral into the Earth via tidal forces alone. But if you've got something as big as the Moon, which can create rather larger tides, then it can travel much faster. The Moon, for example, is moving away from the Earth at 3.8 centimetres per year. Now, the other interesting thing is the effect this has on the Earth. The energy that goes into pushing the Moon away has to come from somewhere, and that somewhere is the Earth's rotation. Pushing the Moon away has caused the Earth to slow down. If you were here a few billion years ago, you might have noticed that the day was only about 20 hours long. It's increased to the 24 hours a day we have at present over that time. And it continues to change, not only due to the Moon's influence, but by whether our water is concentrated as ice at the poles or water at the equator. Even major earthquakes and weather systems can measurably affect the length of the day by a few microseconds. Henry's final comment, which we didn't include here, asks how this applies to exoplanets. The same principle can occur here. Well, migrations of planets in these conditions are also controlled by factors during their formation. Everything from viscous drag in the planetary disks to gravitational interactions between neighbouring planets. All these things come into play here. Tidal forces are important in making the closest in planets spiral into their stars. But that can't explain how they got there in the first place. But that's a whole other question for another time.
Okay, and the third question from John Bordelon says, watching for meteors, I noticed several flashes in the sky. I have seen these in many locales many times while watching the night sky. These points of light do not return in the same spot. What am I seeing?
Good question. We don't know. Every now and again we get legitimate questions from very clever people saying they've said something in the sky. What is it? Well, the truth is that the sky is a big and exciting place in which many things go on. And a written description isn't usually enough to tell what they are, even a very precise one. Often it's confounded by the fact that people say, oh, it was about the size of an elephant, when, because you don't know how far away it is, you don't know how big it is. It could easily have been the size of a pea or the size of a star. The fact of the matter is that our brains and eyes are better designed to find nutritious roots and beasts on the Serengeti than to critically analysing things in the night sky. Now, there are a lot of things that could produce the momentary flashes in the sky that John sees. I've seen some myself. I don't know what they were. A few things that could produce flashes in various guises can be aeroplanes, iridium flare satellites, and meteors. But most seasoned observers can identify these almost all of the time. John isn't the only person to have reported seeing flashes like these, though. But without further details, it's hard to know what's going on. For example, astronauts report seeing similar flashes, which are caused by high-energy particles decaying inside their eyeballs. Now, the Earth's magnetic field protects us from most of these particles on the surface, but not all of them. You can see them on long camera exposures, for example. But particles with energies high enough to punch through the atmosphere tend to get through a lot of other things too. So if John's flashes are caused by decaying high-energy particles, he should still be able to see them when he's in a darkened room. Of course, if you're seeing random flashes, it could just be fundamental damage to your optic nerve, in which case you should go and see a doctor. They'll probably most likely tell you that they don't know what it is either.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Thank you.